I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Okay, I promise this is going to be the last interview about this current administration and the subject of religion for quite a while. Unless Donald J. Trump gets raptured, you're not going to hear anything for a while. The problem is, I keep reading these articles that are so insightful about the current administration and how religion is affecting it and how it is encouraging a certain religious mindset. And I can't help myself. I read these things and then I get in touch with the author and boom, we've got a show. But I realize it's been pretty heavy duty lately. But this is no less interesting and insightful than any of the other shows that we have done on religion and the Trump administration. This particular article that caught my attention on the Religion News Service by Professor Mark Silk is about how Republicans are not going to be helped by people on the religious right, as they have been. And I find this fascinating because so many predictions have been made about religious conservatives and their influence on elections, and many of them have proved to be wrong. But I find that there is tremendous substance in what Professor Silk has to say, and so we're bringing him onto Common Threads. A little bit about our guest. Mark Silk earned degrees at Harvard, including his PhD in medieval history. After teaching at Harvard, he became editor of the Boston Review. In 1987, he joined the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he worked variously as a reporter, editorial writer, and columnist. In 1996, he became the first director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, and in 1998, founding editor of Religion in the News, a magazine published by the center that examines how the news media handle religious subject matter. In June 2005, he was also named director of the Trinity College Program on Public Values. So we welcome to Common Threads Dr. Mark Silk. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Fred. Delighted to be here, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Good. Excellent. So, first of all, tell me, as someone who has been an observer of the political process for so many years, how has your track record been on prognostication? Not necessarily being able to name the winners of particular races, but being able to understand the importance of evangelicals and how they make up, how they contribute to a candidate or not.
You know, I try to stay a little bit away from the prediction game. I'm a historian by training. I think what I try to do is look at what survey data is out there to see. Not just, you know, what different religious groupings think about, you know, political parties and candidates, but also how their size varies over time. And, so there's sort of a web of things which give us a picture over a series of elections of where things seem to be headed, and you know, it usually turns out pretty close. I mean, one of the things that's striking about the religious right, or, you know, white evangelicals, if we want to sort of narrow it down that way, is that they've become, you know, they've become locked into the Republican Party and the Republican candidate over the past several decades to a degree that, you know, we just don't see much variation, and it doesn't matter who it is. And so, depending on how large a group that is in any given election cycle, we can sort of tell how much difference that's going to make again, depending on, you know, whether we're talking nationally or particular races.
And here's the thing. For years and years, I've heard that evangelicals are either losing their influence or they are going to lose their influence. I remember the demise of the Moral Majority. All right, so a particular organization just vanished. And then what was Ralph Reed's organization? Do you remember?
Well, the Christian Coalition.
The Christian Coalition.
Supplanted.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Christian Coalition had their 15 minutes of fame, and then all of a sudden they demised. So these organizations may go away, and people are thinking that, okay, well, that means evangelicals are going away. But they never had. They never have. So I'm wondering, through all of these changes, the morphing of how they're grouped and how they strategize and all of that, did you think at some point over the years that it's a flash in the pan, it's not for long?
I guess I'll plead guilty to thinking that they were a waning force. More recently than that. I mean, it's true, you know, it's exactly true what you say. You know, what was originally called in the early 1980s the New Religious Right, its demise was predicted, and I think, you know, by people who were hoping for it. I mean, you know, hope and prediction sometimes get in the way of each other. You know, there has, at least some people have seen phenomena like the Tea Party that came to the fore in 2010 as sort of evidence of the decline of the religious right, because the Tea Party seemed to be concerned about other things. And then as you looked more closely, you saw that, you know, an awful lot of the people who associated themselves with the Tea Party turned out to be white evangelicals. So I think I've always been cautious about, you know, saying it's all over. I think one of the problems at the moment is that virtually all surveys that are done of particular races, those that mention, you know, involve religion at all, I mean, use a religious criterion or a question in that, only are interested in white evangelicals. And I think the sort of, in a way, that gives overlooks other highly observant or religious, I'll say Judeo-Christians, that is other Christians and Orthodox Jews, and I would include Mormons in that, who themselves are very strong Republicans and also supporters of President Trump. So so I think it's a mistake to be overly, you know, to be sort of exclusively focused on white evangelicals.
So many people were surprised at the amount of evangelical support that Trump has received. And I kind of scratch my head when I see that, because I'm thinking, duh, of course he has the support. He has given them virtually everything that they've asked for, or at least he's attempting to give them everything they've asked for. Would you agree that the current president is more actively seeking to pass legislation or at least invoke executive orders to placate white evangelicals more than any other president in the last 4 decades? So, for instance,
I completely agree with that. And if we can go down the list of things, he's you know, the usual pattern, and this goes back to Ronald Reagan, which was sort of, you know, the Reagan presidency is really the beginning of sort of white evangelicalism as a political force in the country, you know, in the modern era. And the basic position of these earlier Republican administrations, I mean, that is Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2, you know, was to sort of be happy to get their support and to to give lip service to things and to be very cautious about sort of going along with the agenda. There has been sort of certain things like having to do with, you know, what's sometimes called, I guess, the Mexico Accords or something, where there are restrictions on government funding of agencies, international agencies that support abortion. Republican administrations have always done that, but the kind of wholehearted embrace, both in terms of agenda and in terms of visits to the White House and all the stuff that Donald Trump has given white evangelicals, is absolutely unprecedented.
You know, it's interesting because you listed Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2. Now, Bush 1, my take on it is that he really didn't buy into evangelical Christianity wholeheartedly. He really had to sell himself to that particular crowd. I got the impression, and I still believe this, and tell me if I'm naive, I really believe that Reagan was one of them and that Bush, too, was one of them. Do you agree?
I think Bush, too, certainly was. He belonged to a Methodist church. I mean, you know, so he went to Laura Bush's, his wife's church. As part of sort of small group evangelical, you know, so it's sort of mainline. But, you know, one of the things that's worth inserting here is that as your listeners will probably know, or many of them, you know, there is no such thing as, you know, the white evangelical or the evangelical church of America. We sort of have to judge who fits into that category. And the normal way politically to do that is to simply ask either in a survey by phone or an exit poll, especially, you know, do you consider yourself a born again or evangelical Christian? And then if you strip out the non, you know, you sort of focus on the people who also answer that they're white people, that's you know, white evangelicals. Those are the people we're talking about. But in fact, if you then map those answers to against a denominational affiliation, you find quite a substantial number of people who belong to those church, you know, Protestant churches that are mainline. I mean, Presbyterian, you know, especially in places like the South and some parts of the Midwest, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, you know, who consider themselves evangelical, and you know, I guess in Grand Rapids, you know, you've got Dutch Calvinists who would now be fit into that, you know, sort of reformed members of reformed churches who would also answer yes now. So who these people are, you know, have to be, and they're actually, and this is somewhat surprising, but there, you know, there are a fair number of Catholics who will answer yes to that. So it's become it's a somewhat, you know, it's a constructed category that has to be taken with care when we look at that. But in terms of you know, background, Ronald Reagan was, he was raised, and quite seriously so, in a pretty, you know, conservative Disciples of Christ. His mother was Disciples. His father was kind of a Catholic, and that didn't matter. But Reagan was serious that way as a religious, and his minister growing up was quite important to him. And he went, his college was a Disciples school. So although Reagan in his later years wasn't much of a churchgoer, I would say he actually fits into a certain conservative Protestant worldview of an earlier generation anyway, more than some people realize. As you say, George H.W. Bush fit awkwardly into that group. Karl Rove had to sort of run him around in the 1988 election cycle to conservative, you know, evangelical pastors, and and he would have to figure out a way to stammer out how he considered himself born again. But that was a somewhat awkward fit. Compared to Michael Dukakis, however, he wasn't so hard to vote for. George W. Bush, very much in the contemporary evangelical world.
So my question is, after I remind everyone that you're listening to WGVU, the show is Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. Professor Mark Silk is our guest today, and we're talking about religion and the midterms coming up. So I'm curious, why you mentioned giving lip service. Do you really think that Reagan wasn't as serious about the conservative evangelical agenda? And I realize that can mean different things to different people, but there are a few items on that list that are pretty much universal, such as criminalizing abortion and promoting marriage equality, all those kinds of things, and certainly siding with Israel more than mm-hmm. Palestine in that issue. So I'm just curious, do you really think that even though those two presidents theologically were in line, why didn't they go as far as Donald Trump? I guess that's what I'm saying.
Well, I think one of the reasons they didn't go as far is that, you know, they were much more conventional politicians. They had hard-nosed political advisors. Karl Rove was not religious in any way, shape, or form, even though he worked for a religious president, was prepared to take advantage of that part of the coalition. I think they regarded evangelicals as, you know, great to appeal to, but problematic if you could alienate a lot of people, a lot of voters that you needed if you signed on to the agenda too fervently. The Republican Party in the course of the 1970s turns from one which is quite open to abortion rights to one which really allies itself with opposition to abortion. And it actually takes white evangelicals that decade to kind of move. Roe v. Wade is 1973. Really, you don't get locked into an anti-abortion position until, it takes about 5 years. The Catholic Church, of course, is always against abortion and opposed immediately to Roe. The question in those early years was whether to push for a constitutional amendment some strong position like that. But and that was, you know, sort of lurking in the background. But they resisted that. But you'll notice that's nothing that the Trump people haven't done that either. That is, they have, and in fact, the pro-life movement, even as they use very strong language to refer to abortions as murder and so on, you don't hear a lot of talk from them about constitutional amendments. It's not, you know, you haven't heard that in Congress. So part of what's gone on with abortion is a very sophisticated approach to trying to move the country in their direction, limitations on, you know, clinics and doctors and restrictions, you know, on terms. The envelope continues to get pushed, and we'll see what happens if Brett Kavanaugh becomes the next Supreme Court justice. But I think a part of what's happened on the most important of the culture wars issues, that is abortion, is a shift in terms of strategy and tactics on the part of the pro-life folks. But I think there was a, you know, if you take as one example of what Donald Trump has done, and try to answer your question, a sort of fringe of the religious right has made some fuss about the so-called Johnson Amendment, which was a piece of the IRS code that was put in place in the 1950s by Lyndon Johnson to say that no 501c3, no nonprofit, religious or otherwise, but it's certainly his thing was not directed at churches, at religious institutions. None of them could engage in electoral politics and retain their tax exemption. That's the so-called Johnson Amendment. And some people on the religious right have said, you know, we want to have, you know, freedom of the pulpit. We want to be able to endorse and, you know, be involved in politics. The position of the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic one, and everybody has been, that's an eccentric position. We don't really want to go there. Very few religious organizations or bodies are interested in that. It's meaningless. Donald Trump at some point became aware during the 2016 campaign, probably because he asked for the endorsement of, you know, religious groups, you know, that there was such a thing as this Johnson Amendment, and he decided he was against it because he wanted his religious folks to be able to do this. And so he made that a kind of piece of his agenda, that he was going to utterly destroy the Johnson Amendment. And he said that, I believe, at the first prayer breakfast that he was at and all this stuff. And it looked like it was moving ahead as part of the tax bill that passed last year. But really, it didn't finally happen. And I think some of that, you know, so if you say, well, why did Donald Trump sign on to that? Well, he had an interest in, you know, getting the support of the religious folks that he wanted the support of, and he decided that he was going to be in favor of it, even though, you know, everybody, all the smart guys, you know, in Congress and probably in the White House and elsewhere said, this is stupid, Mr. President, but, you know, that's Donald Trump for you.
You know,
that's a long-winded answer, but you know, I think some of it is just, you know, he's very responsive to flattery and to applause and the laying on of, you know, hands and all by people who say declare their undying affection for him, and if anybody's done that to a fare-thee-well, it's been, you know, his white evangelical leaders who he gathers around him and celebrates in all kinds of ways.
There's been this simplistic caricature of the Republican Party over the last couple of decades, that it's made up primarily of white evangelicals, as we've discussed, and also the so-called country club Republicans, those people who have a very significant financial stake in political outcomes. And that the party has been able to embrace both of them. And I get the impression that the country club Republicans sort of, they've tolerated the evangelicals to some degree, because they know, hey, if you're going to vote for Republican candidates, you're going to help us. And apparently the evangelicals have sort of made the same bargain. But so many of the country clubbers don't share those values, don't share the social agenda of the Christian right. I'm curious if you have any insights as to how they've been able to make peace with that.
Well, I mean, as you suggest, the problem with country club Republicans is there aren't enough of them to win elections, and so they need, you know, they need some other dimension of things. You know, I think the evidence is, and you know, this is another thing to put on the table here. You know, I don't think any of, you know, they don't, so they don't care about an, you know, anti-gay agenda, or a, you know, sort of hostility to same-sex marriage. It's not a problem for them. On the other hand, you know, in a certain sense, with the exception of abortion, at least up until recently, you know, an abortion has remained a kind of, you know, sort of, the needle hasn't moved much in terms of public opinion. There have been some states that have moved to restrict abortions in various ways. But, you know, I think if you're a country club Republican in, say, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut, or you know, wherever, you figure, you know, you can live with all that stuff. The basic, you know, these social issues have more or less been losing ground. You know, nobody expected same-sex marriage to get as far as fast as it did. And so, if part of your, if you get the votes for, you know, for big tax cuts from people who, you know, are concerned about those things, well, you know, that's part of the coalition, and it's not going to hurt you. And if abortion is criminalized, you can probably send your, you know, your daughter or whoever it is, you know,
your mistress.
Well, you said it.
Yeah.
You know, to someplace.
You got to
take care
get
of. One.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that those people care when it comes to public policy about one thing, and that's money.
Their portfolio. Mark, we're out of time for this week's edition of Common Threads, but I'd love to have you join us next week and we can continue this. Before we go, people who are interested in your insights, where can they go online to find them?
Well, I do a column twice a week for the Religion News Service called Spiritual Politics, and so they can certainly. I think that's if they care to follow along with this kind of discussion, I do a fair amount of it.
And that's the website is.
Well, it's let's see. If the best way to do that is to go. Go to the Religion News Service website, which is a good thing to go to if you're interested mm-hmm. in that. It's just religionnews.com, and I'm down there in the columns section.
Okay, great. Sounds easy enough.
It is very easy.
Okay, well, we'll talk to you next week. I'm Fred
Looking
Stella.
Forward.
I'm Fred Stella, and with me today was Dr. Mark Silk, and we will discuss more of the midterms, which we didn't get to today, but we will get to next week. Thank you for joining us here on WGVU-FM.